is that the current computer modeling programs don't do it, don't know how to do it, and can't do it. I'm saying let's make something that can. This would be the way to do it.
Mr. Brown and Woodward spent a man year gathering the data that's on those two graphs, the resistive graph and the reactive graph. He spent a man year gathering that data because with the instrumentation they had in those days, you had a drifting signal generator, you had a frequency meter, you hoped that it settled down after hours of warming up. Each time you went to a new frequency, you use your frequency meter to find out what frequency you're on. Then with the slotted line, you carefully measured where the peaks and valleys are, and you carefully measured the number of millimeters on that scale for where you move the probe to find those peaks and valleys. And then in your slide rule, you did a whole bunch of calculations to find out what was the resistive component and the reactive component for that particular test at that particular frequency at this particular time. And then you notch the frequency, you nudge the frequency a little bit and repeat the whole process. Each time they came to a dot on the graph, they did 15 minutes worth of work. In the case of a modern-day vector network analyzer, I get that answer in a millisecond.
Yeah, add GPIB and a couple of computers, and how long would it take to recreate the Brown and Woodward curve?
I suspect that I could do most of the plotting of the Brownwood curve in a day, and it took them a man year.
Probably be done in an hour if you use the right gear.
I accept that. However, theirs was a simpler case. So all they were doing is changing the length and the diameter of a quarter wave approximate monopole on a very large sheet of metal. They were modeling half the dipole, changing the diameters and lengths. They weren't making wide pieces of sheet metal with exotic curves to them, Eric.
You're just resistant to using modern technology. That's the problem here.
I've got a hang up that works for me, Eric. You've got a hang up that you believe will work. You've made a leap of faith. The schooling you had has told you that computer modeling with fast enough computers and gigaflops and teraflops and exaflops are going to do it for you. The exaflops are going to allow you to calculate very rapidly if you've got good raw data.
What I'm talking about.
You've only got an extremely rough approximation as to what is the coupling coefficient between square number 500 and all the other 999 squares. You've only got a very rough approximation.
Well, let's look into Dick's brain, okay? In Dick's brain, when he was presented with this problem that he had solved, he had to go through an awful lot of stuff to try and figure out what's the best approach and what was the best way to do it. And he maybe tried a couple of hundred times without getting the results that he was looking for until he came around to making the right thing that got him where he needed to go. Okay? What's the difference between that and doing it with some automation?
I ain't got a good answer for that one, Eric. With what is available to you and I today, I know a technique that works extremely well, extremely fast.
Well, I'd like to see you teach it to other people.
Then I'm giving away the secret. I'm telling you guys a secret. Well, I trust you guys. You're not going to tell anybody. You're going to keep this close to your chest, aren't you, Eric?
Look, I mean, if you want to look at it from a commercial point of view, if you created a program that does exactly what Dick's brain does and comes up with the right answer, you've got a bit of a gold mine there, don't you? And you don't have to explain to anybody how it works. It just works.
Okay, with Eric's magic computer program, that brain and that magic computer program is going to run the TechNet, and you don't need Eric and Dick anymore. And now the computer program's going to do it for you, Eric. Go ahead.
That day's coming.
How soon? Is it always another 20 years away, just like nuclear fusion?
Well, you've heard of Watson, right?
Oh, yes. It's very good at...
It's very good at recall and association.
At Jeopardy-like questions, it's extremely good. Very specialized.
It's actually gotten better.
I accept that. And now there are physicians that want to use that as a diagnostic procedure. And that's an extremely good application of what is currently...
Not ready.
Say that again?
Really not ready for that. They're getting closer.
Do you believe it has the capability of being a very highly accurate medical diagnostician?
It's only as good as its input, and it's only as good as the folks who wrote the program to do the analysis.
Okay.
Even though Watson is good at certain things, it's because it was coded that way. Put Watson in a car and give it I.O. where things to go, it won't want to do a darn thing until you teach it or write the code that's going to make it take all that I.O. and do something with it. Not that simple, but not impossible.
I accept that, but in the real world of the complication of a human being in the medical world, a hell of a lot of things you only know to a rough approximation. Same thing with this antenna modeling. The coupling coefficients between those thousand finite elements, you only know it to an extremely rough approximation. And if you hope you let the thing grind away in an iterative manner for a long enough period of time, it'll eventually settle down for what looks like a reasonable current distribution with a reasonable phase distribution for that particular element that's a function of that three-element Yagi.
Yes, and that's the beginning of a larger program.
Okay. If you were running a good-sized company today and you had a finite number of people and dollars, would you invest it today to do your computer modeling program as opposed to having Dick teach two other human beings how to use his technique? And that did happen. Over to you, Eric.
Actually, I would expect Dick to be somebody that would probably go up to MIT, get into the physics department and the computer sciences department, gather up a couple of people, teach them what Dick knows, and then have a powwow about how can we improve on this, how can we automate this, how can we take this to the next step, rather than, okay, well, I'll tell you how to do it, go out there and have fun, that's the end of it, and keep it to yourself, or maybe teach it to someone else. There is nothing that can replace the human experience. You as an individual, with your hands, learning how to do something, is light years ahead of what any computer can do. But the computer is very good at documenting what you did and following the path that you created, and if you have the logic in your head and you can translate that into code, you're that much ahead of the game, and you can share that purpose, not necessarily the understanding or the end result of all that work that you've created.
The best physician in the world is somebody like House, who really knows medicine, combined with somebody who is an extremely good electronic engineer and computer maven, and you can put all of that into one head, you've got the best combination. Well, there's a mutually exclusive problem. A person can specialize in RF. You can specialize in microwave RF, and I'm admitting to all you guys every single weekend, I'm extremely light on computer knowledge. I keep forgetting the names of the programs and how to use them. I am computer idiot, computer illiterate. I'm an RF maven who's computer illiterate. There are some computer mavens who are very good with computers, but they're light on RF. To get both of those functions in high quality in the same brain, that's a difficulty. If I use the best vocabulary I have got to talk to this best computer maven that you've got, he's only going to partially understand me. I'm not going to understand any of his language when he talks his computer code to me. So there's a huge gap here, Eric.
I think I sent you to MIT.
Yeah. You think there are guys at MIT who are state-of-the-art in computers and state-of-the-art in microwaves RF simultaneously? You think you can point to one of those individuals?
Actually, I can point to a few of them, not only from MIT, but from Stanford. I know some individuals that are so much into RF and so much into using math and the logic in their head, because that's basically what computer programming, computer science is, the ability to translate, in essence, mathematical algorithms into something a machine can deal with. So, you're an old flat. What can I tell you? You know, get with the program. You actually can be a programmer. Tell me that you don't program your HP calculator to do the things that you need it to do, because it doesn't do it without your input.
Yeah, Walter Lewin arguably is the best physics teacher that MIT has ever had. But I'll bet you if you put him in front of a computer, he's a neophyte. It's my guess. That computer program that I use, that computer handheld machine, my HP 51, has 2,500 functions in all six languages. Reverse Polish, algebraic, basic Fortran, Lisp, and Fortran. All of the major functions, 2,500 of them, as algorithms, are built into that machine. That's an extremely high-level language that I speak to it. I'm not quite sure what all it's doing, and most of the time it does what I want. That doesn't make me a computer maven. I'm slightly skilled at using that particular machine. If I had to really write code that really does it efficiently at the machine level vocabulary, boy, no way in hell are you going to get me to do that in any reasonable finite lifetime that I know of there, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, I'm willing to bet if you got your son in the room, he could bang some sense into you. you're talking about high-level languages. It's exactly the same in computers. There's some more things that you need to know, like how to make it print, how to make it jump on the screen, or how to use this particular thing to make a graph. It's all the same thing. If you're capable of doing that, you're capable of doing the other thing. And I'm sorry to disagree with you in a lot of ways, but today's RF engineers and today's electronic engineers have to learn programming in order to do things like VLSIs. We actually program these large arrays, which have thousands and hundreds of thousands of gates and inverters in them, and they basically do nothing until we program how they get interconnected, and we use a program called Verilog to do that. And actually, Verilog is a little more difficult than some of the simple computer programming, like higher-level computer programming languages we use. So I have a feeling I disagree with you a lot in terms of electronic engineers of today and programming. They go hand in hand, and they're not separated from one another, because most of the hardware that we make today is all microprocessor-driven. So, you know, it used to be you built a servo circuit that was, you know, maybe 30 or 40 op amps and D to A's and level shifters and stuff like that. Now we do it in one little chip.
Okay. I think we're going to go over to the space report right now.
I want to hear that recording.
Okay, let's hear the recording. Joe, if you're available, W-A-2-L-Y-Y, fire away with your recording, K-2-L-I-W in the tech net.
It's too bad you can't talk to your son at dinner. Maybe you can solve all these problems. You could be the RF scientist, and he could be the computer scientist. Do you agree?
It certainly would be a step up from an awful lot of what's taken place that I know of. However, I've got a fair amount of, what's the word for it? OCPD, is the best way I can describe it, excessive compulsive. He's got more of it. And when you get two people in two separate fields in the same room with those restrictions, they can't talk to each other very long without getting into some pretty strong arguments. So it's not quite as compatible as a combination as you think, Joe. We're working on that. Play us a recording, Joe. Play us these wild sounds that came out of your receiver. W-2-L-Y-Y, K-2-L-I-W in the tech net.
Sounds like you're talking about antimatter and matter, or whatever. Here you go. This is recorded last week in AM. It's, I'm not going to play the entire length of it, but not in FM, not in USB or LSD. Totally recorded in AM mode. Here you go. Now, see if somebody out there in tech land can guess the tone.
Thank you.
sounds like 60 lines a minute back to me. Anyway, that's what I take it for, but I'd like to listen to it with a beeper on it.
QG then.
Go ahead, Glenn. No, sorry about that, Bill.
And that's why we both live in the same place. So I've only heard something like that once before, and it was exceptionally noisy when I heard it. It sounds to me like it might be JT-65B, which I did actually hear on Moonbound. And it's typically, obviously, weak signal, slow type of communication.
If the JT-65 sent in AM, or because there are simultaneous tones there and he's listening with AM and they're beating against each other, it really is intended for sideband reception. What's your guess on that one, Bill?
My recollection is, where I heard it last was when Arecibo was doing EME on 432. A number of years ago, and I had a 7-element Yagi over here that I was just pointing up at the moon and trying to hear anything, and I was able to hear a couple, a little bit of CW, but nothing I could decode. What was interesting to me is I could actually hear the sort of, those musical kind of things much better than the CW, and I sent the folks that were doing that test to those transmissions a wave file of what I decoded, and they actually decoded it for me and sent it back, which was kind of interesting, along with the QSL. And my recollection was I was listening, I think, in sideband. That was the mode of my DMOD.
Yeah, I'm very strongly of the belief that it would have to be sideband. The reason for that, amplitude modulation is extremely linear when it's done right, if and only if you've got a 40 or a 50 dB carrier to noise ratio. You get down to a weak carrier to noise ratio of amplitude modulation, it is extremely nonlinear. Amplitude in versus of the modulation versus amplitude out of audio. Sideband has the ability to be linear. So I am guessing, my guess is that all the JT weak signal techniques of Joe Taylor, your JT65D and whatever, I think it's intended for linear sideband demodulation. Let's see if Eric agrees with that. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One note again. This is totally received on HF frequencies, not moon bounce or anything else. I copy this on 1840 kilohertz, 3578 kilohertz, and today I got it on 7078 kilohertz.
Did you say 7078?
That is correct, 7078 kilohertz.
Yeah, well, most of the JTs are optimized in sideband. But there's one form, I can't remember whether a JT is something different, but the Aries guys and a few other people were using it as audio through FM. They were going through those pieces. I don't remember what format that was, but I think it is something similar to that. Listening to the different frequencies AM-wise, it's reasonably narrowband, that's for sure, what we're listening to. So, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's actually a question. This is 7078, translate to 7 megahertz and 48 hertz. When you move towards higher frequency or lower frequency, did you hear the carrier or you did not? And to XGN.
I can hear the carrier. I can hear it. When I go off the carrier, I'm listening to trying to listen to a narrow AM mode. And the pitch does not change when I change my receiving frequency. Okay? The pitch does not change. I tried that before I recorded it. It's definitely coming in with some sort of AM mode transmission, not SSB.
So, if it was not SSB, and you were in the sideband mode, you didn't hear a constant tone as you moved the dial?
Wrong. Was the carrier versus the signal? the one of the sidebands of the AM signal. Into XVM.
I had my receiver in the AM mode, not SSB.
Got you. No more questions. Dick.
Isn't this JT64HF, WB2BXI?
BXO, I think you could very well be right. So very weak signal, very low. And it's intended to be listened to in the sideband mode is our guess, although Joe did hear a continuous carrier. Joe, you have, I'm pretty sure, the ability to look at that signal on something like a spectrum analyzer. Is that true, Joe?
One thing I want to throw in there, if it's actually AM, you listen to it in the sideband mode, you'll hear the BFO, you'll hear a carrier tone. You'll hear a tone, depending upon where you turn the dial, it'll be constant because it's an AM carrier.
Maybe you're supposed to zero beat the AM carrier, but still sideband mode and maybe dual sideband mode. So do you have the ability of looking at it with a spectrum analyzer, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW?
Well, the answer to that is yes. The problem is, will I receive it with a strong enough signal? I'm using a service monitor, which typically has a sensitivity of about 2.5 microvolts. That's nominal, fairly nominal. It doesn't really even see stuff down at microvolts. So I would have to have a signal at fairly good level, 2, 3, 4, 5 microvolts, to demodulate it successfully, to see what I'm saying. And I don't know if this stuff comes in that strong. It wasn't very strong any time I've heard it. Maybe it's an S5, S7. Something like that. I know on an HF receiver you think that's a lot of signal, but, my FC is a little loose side or whatever. But anyway, next time I hear it, I'll try to use the service monitor and see if I can absolutely decode it that way, and that would answer your question. But I could just tell you what I received on an HF receiver.
You got an IF out for you, the HF radio?
What was the width of the signal? Was it 5 kilohertz? Was it 6 kilohertz?
Joe, you can put a preamplifier in front of your service monitor to solve the weak signal problem. And back to you, Joe.
No, you can't. You can't use those things without a filter in front of them, otherwise you blow them out. I know what you're thinking about doing. You can't do that.
The IF added a receiver. Stuff that into the spectrum analyzer. And what's added on the scope? Look at your recording on the scope.
I can try that. What are you trying to get me to prove? That it's absolutely an AM carrier I'm listening to, or some other mode of modulation? I was thinking about this. What if it's two carriers being produced by a transmitter at once, where they're only changing the frequency of one carrier in relationship to the other one? One may be staying on a steady frequency, and one may be switching in frequency, higher or lower, away from the other carrier. How's that for a possibility?
Jesus.
No.
I'm trying to get you to determine whether it's FSK or PSK, the kind of modulation that I associate what I'm hearing with.
Bill QGZ, tell us what you think's going on.
Okay, Eric brought up a very interesting point. I think the mode he was talking about is called NBEMS or something like that. And I've never actually heard that over the air, although I know a couple guys have used it. One way to rule that out, now that's meant to be sent over FM or presumably AM or, you know, in other words, any mode like that where you can even acoustically couple your speaker to your microphone. So if that's the case, you can find the NBEMS software to demodulate available online, and it's made to be acoustically coupled from your speaker. So if you have a computer microphone or something, you know, off you go. So that would rule that in or out pretty quickly. And again, that's a mode, that's, I guess you can send it in whatever mode you'd like, but it would work on AM.
Bill, what was that crazy mode designed for? What was the application?
So it was, in other words, I guess the way it's supposed to play out is you know, you have a copy of it loaded on your laptop, and the distant station has a copy of it loaded on his laptop. It has a bunch of the ARIES and RACES and incident command, you know, FEMA incident command system, ICS forms loaded on it. And you populate the form and hit send, and it appears on the other end.
down to a low enough frequency into the IF strip of the receiver, which already has the bandpass filtering and the gain, I think you can get above the threshold of your service monitor, which seems to be the best spectrum analyzer you've got, and now get enough gain to get above its threshold. So looking at it with a spectrum analyzer, and by the way, here's the next problem. What's the narrowest mode of resolution bandwidth of your service monitor? In this case, you need hundreds of hertz. You might not have that. Over to you, Joe.
First of all, I'm going to be very resistive in doing that. I had a bad experience many years ago using another receiver, an R7000. I was looking at the IF output, which is about 10.7 megahertz, and as I changed frequencies, the output from the IF thing actually popped the diode in the mixer of the service monitor. I'm very resistant to doing that. It somehow spiked at a very high level output as I changed frequencies. I know exactly what you wanted to do. I'm going to have to come up with another way of doing that. I don't want to hook that to something where I'm going to have a possibility of causing damage to something.
I guess you've never heard of pad. It's more than just padding. When you tap into a receiver, you got to be very careful with how you do it. Even with capacitive coupling, it can be a voltage transient that'll blow out your diodes. You really need an LC network where there's an L to ground, making sure there's no DC component, a coupling capacitor, and so on. So when you're tapping into a receiver, particularly where the probe you're using might go off a little bit to one side, touch B plus by mistake, there's only a zillion ways you can wipe out the mixer front end of a spectrum analyzer. Out of curiosity though, Joe, what is the narrowest resolution bandwidth you can on your service monitor? Over to you, Joe.
That is still going down to 1 kilohertz per division, but I do not know what the bandwidth is. It's automatically adjusted and selected internally in the instrument. It's not like my HP, where I can leave the span one setting and leave the bandwidth another setting. I can't do that with this instrument. It's automatically adjusted. If I go down to a horizontal dispersion rate of 1 kilohertz, I imagine the bandwidth is fairly narrow, but I don't know exactly what it is.
There's a way you can estimate it though, Joe. When you're down to 1 kilohertz per horizontal centimeter, so to speak, when you do see a single signal on that screen, roughly how wide is that signal? Is it less than 1 centimeter wide? In which case, maybe you've got a 200 hertz filter when you're at the 1 kilohertz per centimeter mode. Over to you, Joe.
What's the model number of your IFR?
1500.
I'll look it up, but if I remember correctly, it does actually tell you what the resolution bandwidth is.
Okay, what are you getting at? Why do you want to know the bandwidth of this signal? Why is this very important to you? You think it's not being transmitted in AM or some other type of modulation?
This FSK is going to be within a couple of hundred hertz of each other.
In order to really see the individual components of that complex signal, you'd like to have, let me pick a number, 50 hertz or 100 hertz of resolution bandwidth on your display device in order to be able to see what's happening. Other than that, the individual components are going to be mixed together in a complex way in your spectrum analyzer, and therefore the interpretation becomes a lot more difficult, Joe. Over to you, Joe.
Yeah, I don't think this service monitor is going to serve that purpose and be able to, you know, look at something, talk about something that's very, very narrow between one frequency and another. It can't separate stuff that much. Even a carrier, putting a carrier into my HP generator will take up maybe like a half a box each side from the center, graphical, if I have about 1 kilohertz. So, I mean, you're just looking at a carrier with no modulation. It's not that terribly, you know, narrow. It's not like a pinpoint.
We've got a solution. Stand by. There's a man within the sound of my voice right now who has the most sophisticated kind of a spectrum analyzer for audio signals, which if you want will go down to millihertz of resolution. It's called an HP3561. John, KC2WGV, do you know anybody who's got a machine like that, such an exotic thing? Over to you, John.
Well, you send them a wave file.
Yeah, I've got two of them, Dick.
He's down to his last two. Only two.
I have a better suggestion. John, since you have the instrumentation, why don't you listen to these frequencies from time to time and see if you can pick up what I listen to. And, you know, maybe you don't hear it on 160, but try 80 meters. I've heard it, like I said, 35, 78. Today I heard it on 70, 78. And on 160, I heard it on 40, I think it's either 1840 or 1838. I wasn't sure the exact frequency.
I bet you've got receivers for those frequencies, and I bet you've got a long wire antenna. And I guarantee those signals are getting to Staten Island. They're not avoiding that beautiful island. Over to you, John.
Joe, could you give me those frequencies again? Now I have a pen. I'm going to write them down, and I'm going to listen, see what I can find out. And time of day matter?
They seem to like to be on when the TechNet's on, curiously enough. The first one, I believe, is it's I've heard it at 1840, but maybe the guy shifted frequency, you know, because 1840 kilohertz, possibly also 1838. I also heard it on 3578 and 7078 kilohertz.
And QGZ with info.
Very good, Joe. I've written them down, and I will monitor that.
Over to you, Bill.
A web search of 3578 digital modes brought me to a wiki page for JT9, which is supposed to have even better noise performance than the JT65. It's a 9 FSK mode, so that sounds like it might fit. And there's a bunch of information there as well, so that that may be JT9.
You see, somebody comes up with the answer.
So what's the easiest way to get to that particular website, Bill? Just plug in that frequency as a Google search and it'll find it for you?
Yeah, I just put in 3578 digital mode, and I got a wiki page about the weak signal. And it shows 3578, 3579 as the 80-meter range for that mode, or, you know, to where people from that mode go to meet up.
Fantastic. Just like Joe said, looks like we've already got a solution. We don't need instrumentation. And so Wiki explains the mode. Joe Taylor is the creator of these Reed-Solomon-like modulation techniques that have super weak capability. So looks like we've got it made. As you scan that Wiki article, it probably explains the fact that super weak signals and quite a bit of QR Mary, this signal mode can survive. Is that sort of the purpose here, Bill? Mr. QGZ, K2RIW.
I'm actually kind of digging into it now. They have a audio recording of it, which doesn't sound exactly like what Joe played. Maybe he can... I believe it's called... give me one second. I'll give you the actual web address, and maybe Joe can listen to it locally and, you know, compare them side by side.
Don't forget, Joe said he was listening to that on AM, I believe, Dick.
That's just the way he picked it up. That's not necessarily the Joe Taylor recommended technique for demodulating it. When it comes to weak signals, it is my belief no one in his right mind would ever use amplitude demodulation, because when the signal gets weak, amplitude is extremely nonlinear. Single sideband is extremely linear, no matter how weak the signal is. So I'm guessing that the intended demodulation mode for the Joe Taylor technique is probably sideband-like. Over to you, Bill, for any comments on this. K2LIW.
Okay, I can give you the web address of that, the wiki page I found. It's www.sigidwiki, Sierra India Golf India Delta Whiskey India Kilo India .com stroke wiki stroke JT9. So it's www.sigidwiki.com stroke wiki stroke JT9. And there's seems like there's samples of a bunch of different modes there. So maybe if you look at the JT65, that those sounds may line up a little bit better. And I dig that it, you know, it doesn't make sense that it would have come out that way in AM, but maybe this should just how it demodulates. So that's it for me. Back to that WB2Q.
In order for the JT Joe Taylor modes to give you the whole vocabulary, the whole alphabet and numbers, there has to be a sequence of multiple tones frequently transmitted simultaneously. Therefore, these tones are beating against each other, and in the AM mode, you're going to hear tones. That's not the intended method of demodulation. As I said, I believe that nobody's right mind would use amplitude modulation, demodulation on a weak signal. It's extremely nonlinear. The magic of sideband is that the missing carrier gets re-injected at the receiver. Therefore, that carrier is pure, and the demodulation amplitude is extremely linear, even though it's noisy. And, okay. Does anybody object now if we go over to the space section of the TechNet? Speak up now or forever hold your peace. K2LIW, are you listening?
And don't forget, Dick, you wanted to mention something about Space 2 when Paul gets started.
Yeah. I'm going to let Paul start a little bit, and then I'll inject what I think is, to me, a minor breakthrough of space reception. WS2N. Has NASA done anything this week, Paul? WS2N with a space report? Space report number 197, I believe. K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, that's what I have, 197. And I didn't know we were finished with John's email, though. Didn't he have more?
Go right ahead, Dick. No problem.
That's a good point. Did you have one more email, John? Go right ahead.
That's all right, Dick. Not necessary. We're late already.
The word late is relative. I've got only 10:30. And Paul is very brief. He's only going to take 5 minutes. I'm having fun with Paul. Address to N, K2IW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. The couple of items I have, but the most important thing I thought was that, you know, that happened last week was the return of the booster of the Falcon 9. The whole stack went up to the aimed for the International Space Station to bring supplies and the beam, the new Bigelow expandable activity module to the space station. It was all 100% success, launched by SpaceX. This 229-foot-tall rocket took off, and the most important part for SpaceX, and interesting, was the return of the booster to the, some people call it a barge. Elon Musk, he likes to call it a ship because it doesn't have any rudders on board, but it's got four big engines that turn around 360 degrees, so he's calling it a ship. It landed on it and stayed upright. And they had a support ship, you know, come by that SpaceX has. It stands by about 3 miles off shore. Nobody on the landing ship. The thing is abandoned when there's a landing attempt. As you know, couple of times in the last year and a half, the rocket has landed, exploded, landed, fallen over. Well, this time it landed perfectly and upright, and then the support ship came by and secured it to the deck, and it went back to Florida all the way to Cape Canaveral like that, standing up, which was pretty interesting. They put these welded shoes on the big U-bolts, really big, and they go around the legs of the spacecraft and weld it to the deck, and they brought it back, and I saw pictures of them unloading it with a big crane, folding the legs up, and putting it horizontally, and they're going to bring it back and get it ready to be brought out to pad 39A. They probably won't bring it to 40, where they normally launch. That's going to be occupied. They have many, many flights that they have to get ready for. So they'll probably bring it out to 39A. That's the future launch complex where they're eventually going to launch people from on the Dragon. Or maybe the
Falcon 9 Heavy, which will be three Falcon 9s all at once, all bolted together. So we'll see how that goes. They're going to have 10 five.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Early as June, relaunch the same booster. Now, so that was like part A of CRS-8, which is the commercial resupply mission that they, you know, they've done sent many Dragon cargo vehicles up to the space station. And this was number 8 of the paid version that NASA paid them to do it. And with that, they docked to the space station on the node called the Harmony node on the Earth facing side, and unloaded just yesterday morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. Had the robotic arm come out, actually controlled by Mission Control in Houston, grabbed a hold of the beam, and put Bigelow's inflatable module attached to the aft port assembly of the Tranquility module. So that's all bolted together, and then they'll have to wait until roughly the end of May, and they'll inflate this thing and bring it up to its proper pressure. So that was pretty good. Very successful. Bigelow's happy with it. And also, United Launch Alliance is very happy with the launch. Because they've just partnered with Bigelow a couple of days ago. They made a deal with Bigelow that they'll be launching their new, not the Beam, but a bigger version of Beam, much bigger. Beam is 5% the size of this other thing that they want to send up, called the BA-330. BA-330 is a self-contained vehicle, really doesn't even need any other support modules attached to it, but you could have six astronauts on board if you wanted to occupy this thing. After it's put into space, it's going to be another inflatable, expandable module type of deal, but much larger. And they're even in contact with NASA, trying to make an arrangement to actually attach it to another port on the International Space Station. They made a deal with each other to launch two of these BA-330s. So that's going to be pretty interesting. That all should happen probably as early as 2019. And Dick, I wonder if you went and found out the name of your stove as I take a break in between you. Or any other questions before we move on? K2RIW, WS2N, space portion of the TACNET.
Yeah, I forgot. On your next portion of the space net, I'm going to go look for the name of the stove. In the meantime, Derek is there. Eric, when it comes to the exotic shape of the antennas I'm talking about, if you go to patent number 7205953, I'll repeat that. U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, you go to patent number 7205953, the patent number 3 element Yagi made out of sheet metal. That's extremely broadband and extremely low in Vizwar at 902 to 928 inclusive megahertz. And you look at figure 1 and figure 3. And you look at figure 3 of that patent, of that manufactured antenna. And you'll say to yourself, why in the world does it have that crazy shape? And I told you how that crazy shape came about. Wonder if you need to repeat on any of that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Okay, maybe Eric's not here. Paul, you continue with the space report. I'll go read the name of the oven. I can carry a handy talkie while I'm in that part of the house, so I'll hear everything you say. WS2N with section 2.
plane, Dick.
Was that Eric?
Yes, it was. Give me a second. I get to a better radio.
Okay. Are you ready to write?
What was the question?
Are you ready to write? I'm going to give you a seven-digit number of a patent. And when you go by whatever means you've got, look up that patent and look at figure number one and figure number three. You know something about what I've been talking about. Tell me when you're ready to write.
In about a minute.
Okay. Alrighty. I'll turn it over to Paul to give us the next section of a space report while I go read the crazy name of my oven. Go ahead, Paul. KQIW.
Hey, Eric, it looks more like an orthopedic device than an antenna, I tell you that.
Eric's on the way for another radio. This new module that Bigelow and United Launch Alliance plans on launching is so big and so heavy that even the Falcon 9 can't put it up there. They need to use the Atlas 5. That's the United Launch Alliance's big rocket, and they could launch this 43,000-pound thing that they want to put up. You know, it sounds big, it sounds heavy, but after it expands, it's going to be very big. The diameter is going to be like 45 feet long with a 22-foot diameter. Big living space. I think the beam is going to go good, and for them to team up with one another, the United Launch Alliance is really Boeing and Lockheed. You know, they call themselves the United Launch Alliance when it comes to launching Atlas V rockets. So for them to team up with Bigelow, it's almost a sure shot that they'll be able to do this probably within a couple of years. BA-330 is actually being constructed now. So if I go into another part of this net, let's see if Dick's back. And maybe Eric's got his radio, the other radio. K2RIW, WS.
Come back and I'm ready.
I don't think Dick's back. He's got to find the name on this thing now. You sound different on that radio, Eric.
Say that again, Paul.
I'm back.
Sound much different on this radio. It's probably got a different mic or something to it. You sound different than you did an hour ago. I heard Dick. He's back. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, while I was going, John could have fed them that number. John's just already looked it up. The patent number, U.S. patent number, 7205953. I'll repeat that, 7205953. It's one of the 30 so-called crazy patents on these funny kinds of antennas. But you go to that patent number by whatever patent search mode you got there, Eric, and look at particular figure number one and figure number three, and you'll see what I'm talking about. By any ordinary means, you would never come up with that design. But you just paste pieces of copper down on an insulated sheet, pieces of a copper tape, and you keep looking at higher and higher performance. And in one particular method of approach, you end up with that crazy shape that has that performance. By any other means, you would never arrive at that by today's currently available computer modeling. You'd have to break up that shape with, I think, close to 1,000 finite elements. Need a fill on that? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Well, I'm willing to bet if you get your son in the room, we could take this discussion to a place that you won't agree with. But, again, whatever the human experience is can be translated. So that doesn't mean that it'll go outside the parameters of your experience, but there's ways to expand on things. But anyway, I'll take a look at this. I'm sure it's going to be something that something in your brain took you in that direction, or it was a process of discovery that brought you to that particular place. I mean, when you started this, I bet you didn't know you were going to wind up with what we wound up with. If you did, then you'd have been thinking about it an awful lot.
You're partially right, Eric. I didn't have the vaguest idea that it wind up with anything that looks like that. And by the way, that is the high-performance antenna that has the most amount of manufacture. Thousands and thousands of those things were manufactured in Southeast Asia at a very attractive price. But that's not the wildest one. At a later time, I'll show you an even wilder shape of an antenna with even higher performance. I mean, the normal two-wheeler criteria, telling you the maximum bandwidth you can get out of an antenna when you know the number of wavelengths of its length, width, and height. When you know the volume of the antenna, two and wheeler tells you what's the maximum bandwidth you can get. And at a later time, I'll show you a patent number done by a similar technique with an even wilder shape, which exceeds two-wheeler by almost 5 to 1. The antenna should be something like 10 megacycles wide maximum, and the antenna at 915 megacycles is 150 megahertz wide, and my definition of wide is where the reflection coefficient is 25 dB down. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Okay, well, you're discovering nature. You do realize that just about everything physical in nature can be related to actually fractals, which is a whole other thing. But there is a certain kind of beauty in nature that doesn't necessarily follow logic, and your antennas just don't have to be any different.
The organization I was working with had hired a guy with a doctorate degree in antenna design, with 25 years of experience at the Naval Research Laboratory in Rhode Island, and he was extremely skilled at two of the best modeling programs, and he tried modeling this antenna and the other one, and the model says, not even close. The model told you that you're just barely in the parking lot. You weren't even in the ballpark. But that's another discussion for another time. The crazy year zero range and oven is well built, WELBILT. It went out of business 25, 30 years ago, and even the spare parts disappeared 25 years ago. And I've been modifying spare parts ever since. I bet you've never heard of that brand name, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RW, K2J. Yes, I actually have, but I was assuming it was some various different names, just like Hot Point, Westinghouse, and those kinds of things, because this house had a Hot Point stove, which is actually manufactured by GE, so, you know, even to this day, you can get parts for it. But now you've got your problem there, and depending upon the size of the stove, you ought to go out and buy a new one. They're not that expensive.
Every single stove that I can buy will not meet the house. The worst one is the oven. This is a very narrow oven, rather tall. It's got enough volume, but it's very narrow. Well, the right-hand side of the oven hits the outer frame of the back door of the house. The left-hand side hits something else that can't easily be moved. So without a major modification of the kitchen, we're not going to put a modern-day oven in that place. Over to you, Eric.
No, that doesn't mean you can't custom in the space that you have available, put a cooktop, maybe a custom top and cabinet, or put a cabinet in its place and mount the oven somewhere else on the wall. I mean, they make separate items like that. They're pretty efficient.
Yeah, it's not going to be a few hours work on my part. It's going to be a major project and maybe hiring a contractor to do it right. And we're not smart enough to make the commitment to do that yet.
What's the width of that stove? It should be a standard width.
That's the problem. It is an extremely non-standard width. I'm an extra around. I'll take a ruler. and measure the damn thing. It is a width that nobody has got, not even for things that are intended for a recreation home, a trailer. Continue with the space report, Paul, while Eric looks up that patent and he tells us how easy it is to model that thing. And that's not the most tough one. That's just I'm just giving him a little bit of a sniff of what's going on here. WS2N with section 3 of the space report. K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I just wanted to mention a company called SES, the world's largest company that builds and puts satellites, or at least pays to have satellites up in geosynchronous orbit. I think they got over 50 that they have up there, and they need to replace an average of 3 or 4 per year. The average geosynchronous satellites last around 15 years or so, some longer, some less. So their goal is now to have these things somewhat serviceable to be refueled, and there's two ways of doing it, and they've gotten involved with Orbital ATK. They're the ones that launch, I've talked about many times before, they're the ones that launch Cygnus spacecraft up to the International Space Station, and they have their own rocket, their Antares rocket, and they also do a lot of other things. They build the boosters for the space shuttle, and now they're building the boosters for SLS, the Space Launch System. Well, this SES is getting involved with them to build a satellite that can go up and attach, you know, go up to geosynchronous orbit and start attaching themselves to other satellites. And all the new satellites that they're building are coming with this grappling type of, what, I don't know if I want to call it docking, but an attachment mechanism. They'll be able to send the this fueling satellite up, attach it to the other existing satellite, and then...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They'll be able to move it around and continue its operation. They'll also work with another company planning a plan B to actually refuel satellites. You'll be able to send a satellite up, go to one of the SES satellites and actually refuel it in space, and then go off to maybe another satellite and do the same thing. But they have these not too distant plans. I mean, any new satellites that are being set up are going to have this grappling attachment mechanism so that they can do this in the future. So we talked about that quite a few times on the net about doing this type of thing, and here they are, the biggest geosynchronous commercial satellite provided now